Representative Jensen's excused today, and call our skeleton crew to order here to see what kind of damage we can cause. We don't have a quorum yet, so we won't be able to pass all those dangerous things Representative Anderson would like to pass out of here.
Not all of them.
Okay. We're going to take some invited testimony this morning, and let me call our first witness, Joe Alario, who needs to be out of here early. So we'll, Rocky, if you don't mind, we'll move him ahead.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee, for taking me out of order. I need to go to the mental health parity meeting directly after this. So another health policy issue that could easily be before this committee before we're done with this legislative session. For the record, my name is Joel Ariel. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here today to give you an overview of the health insurance regulated marketplace. Appreciate this opportunity to testify. The Oregon Insurance Division regulates Oregon's health insurance industry, including 823 different health insurers and health care service contractors. Our mission is to administer the insurance code for the protection of the insurance buying public while supporting a positive business climate. In an introductory section of the insurance code, this legislature has told us that the code is to be, quote, liberally construed for the benefit of the insurance buying public, and that is what we do. What I'm going to talk about this morning is first an overview of the regulated insurance market in Oregon, talk particularly about the individual and small group and portability marketplaces, which are the three that we primarily regulate, and then conclude with a few comments on broader trends within the health insurance marketplace. The starting point for understanding our market is that the health insurance market is basically run by large domestic carriers. More than 80% of our market is controlled by half dozen or so domestic carriers, and then there are a much larger number of what we call in insurance world foreign carriers, which means they're domesticated in some other state, that have kind of niche marketplaces. But most of the insurance in the state is delivered by Regions, Kaiser, and a handful of other large insurance companies here in Oregon. The main issue that we see in the marketplace is continued rate increases. When I give you the details here, you'll see that we're still in double-digit increases, and that causes a number of issues within the regulated marketplace. But before I get into the three markets that we regulate, I'll explain a little bit about what we do and don't regulate in the marketplace. In order to understand insurance regulation, first I have to understand that we don't regulate big chunks of the marketplace. Most of the health insurance or health coverage in the state is provided either through large employers through that are self-insured, and most employers over the size of 100 lives have the ability, if they want to self-insure, and many of them do that. And then secondly, the federal government is in charge of about a third of the market through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. If you take those programs out, the remaining portion of the marketplace, individual and group insurance, is subject to our regulation, and three of those markets, individual, portability, and small employer, which cover approximately 500,000 lives here in Oregon. So that's basically the market that we regulate. About 500,000 lives are the key regulatory focus. We do have some regulatory control over large group insurance, 51 lives or more, but it's much less significant than our regulation of the smaller markets. So what is happening in the individual and small group markets? The starting point here is that in the 1990s, those of you who were around back then, the legislature went through a number of reform efforts to increase the affordability and availability of health insurance. Those efforts did focus on individual and small group markets because these were the primary areas with access problems. Larger groups generally were able to use their pooled experience, the law of large numbers, to find reasonable coverage, and most employers provided that coverage. That's still basically true today, with large employers providing much more insurance than smaller employers, although we are, because of the double-digit rate rate increases that continue year to year here. We are seeing some drop-off in coverage, even among the large groups. Not so much dropping coverage entirely, but restricting who's covered, say, excluding part-time employees or dependents. And then, this is a trend throughout the healthcare market, increasing cost-sharing for the employees. For individual and small group coverage, the insurance division approves both the content of insurance contracts and the rates charged for coverage before those contracts and rates can be used in the marketplace. Our contract review ensures that mandated services are included. There's some 20-some mandates that are part of health insurance, and we review for those. And there are also other kinds of consumer protection standards we look for in the contracts. On the rating side, we basically look to ensure that the rates are actuarial. Sound meet that test, and then there are other rating restrictions in the various market sectors as well. The most important of those is that in the small group and portability markets, you cannot use health status as a rating variable. For small groups and portability coverage is the kind of bridge coverage that's available. If you've been in group coverage, lose your group coverage for one reason or another, you have a right in Oregon, as you do in all other states, to a portability coverage at a guaranteed issue, meaning that there are no health underwriting of the coverage. You can go right into the portability coverage. In those two markets, there is no use of health status. In the individual market, insurers can deny coverage, so you can be denied coverage in an individual market if you have health problems, but it has to be done by reforms that have been adopted in this legislature through the use of a standardized health statement. So there are only certain questions the insurers can ask through a standardized health statement, and then with a couple exceptions that I'll discuss in a minute, if you are accepted after that health statement, you have the right to choose among any of the individual plans offered by that carrier in this state, and you cannot be rated on your health experience. So once in the market, you're rated on your age, essentially, but not on health status. Applicants that are denied coverage or offered restricted coverage for the reasons I'll talk about in just a minute are eligible for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool or OMIP, the state's high-risk pool. Rocky will talk to you about that in a few minutes. In 2003, the legislature relaxed some of the individual and small group regulation in order to achieve specific goals, and we're currently in the process of measuring these. So this gets a little bit technical, but if you work with me for a minute, I'll give you some of the basic detail there, because I think it's important. We've talked over the years about how is the best way to strike a balance in the individual and small group market, where you allow the insurers to function as flexibly as possible in a market system, but also try to ensure that the least healthy risks aren't excluded from the market and don't end up on the public side of the equation wherever you can. So we've tried to strike that balance and more or less did that through the 90s. In 2003, we slightly tweaked the balance to allow a little more flexibility into the market. But when we did that, we said we're going to look at these things carefully for a four-year period, and we're going to see if they actually work to help the market in the ways that the carriers in particular predicted they would work. So we're in the middle of that experiment right now. What are those restrictions? Well, first of all, in the individual market, the legislature allowed insurers to impose waivers of coverage on pre-existing conditions for up to 24 months. There was before that a six-month pre-ex exclusion, but now a particular condition you come in with can be excluded from your coverage for up to 24 months. And also, a carrier, instead of saying, yes, I'll accept you, and that means you can choose among all my plans, can say, I'll accept you, but I'll only accept you for one plan or only for these two plans. So it allowed more carrier flexibility in the market. What was the purpose of that? The purpose was that to increase the number of people who are covered in the individual market, to increase the number of yes decisions made by insurance companies, so that there would be fewer people who would end up in OMIP. The jury is very much still out on this one, mostly because the carriers haven't yet used these new opportunities that they have in the market. As of our most recent data, which is from June of 2004, only 140 community health plans altogether had been issued with either of these situations. Most of those were in the area of choice, restricting the choice of plan. There are only, again, as of June 2004, only 10 waivers so far granted or offered in Oregon by the health plans.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. So why is that? Why haven't more plans taken advantage of that?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, good question. They say that they're still, most of the carriers say that they're still intent to offer these things. It's systems difficulties, particularly with the waivers, to adapt their systems to be able to track and offer appropriately waivers has proven more difficult than they thought. The last time we discussed this with the carriers, which was last week at one of our advisory committee meetings, a couple of the carriers are starting to say, we're not sure we're going to do it because it's taken so long and it's so complicated. But still, the general answer from most of the carriers was, we still intend to do it. It's just taken longer to get our systems revamped in order to be able to do it. More carriers say that they're going to offer the restricted choices, and I don't really have a good explanation for why those aren't offered more frequently yet. But part of it may also be a reflection of when we have these discussions of the small group and the individual market, there's a lot of general discussion at the beginning usually about how it'd be nice if we could relax some of the regulatory barriers and so forth. And then when we get into the detail, you know, people more or less come back to, well, you know, anything that we change here, if we tweak it a little bit this way, we're not sure what other consequences there may be. And maybe we've actually struck pretty much the right balance already, and maybe there's not a whole lot we can do to improve things in this marketplace. So some of it may be that, too, that just once you look at these things carefully, the carriers decide there's really not as much gain in these options as maybe they thought there was when they were proposing them here.
Well, you've given us a lot of information. It's just, it takes a little slow in absorbing all this. But in the previous paragraph, you mentioned applicants that are denied coverage and therefore available for to get the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, OMIP, the high-risk pool. So can you talk some about how much more expensive that is or what the expense is for that pool?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the rates there are set by the OMIP board, and Rocky can speak to this in much more detail, but in general terms, the board has exercised its authority to keep rates as close to the private market as possible. In other words, there's more flexibility in the statutes to take rates up, but the board, which is composed primarily of carriers, has decided for public policy reasons to keep rates fairly competitive with the private market rates. But again, Rocky can, he's the expert, he can speak to that more specifically.
Thank you, Joe. Richard Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, I'm anxious that the 2003 legislative fix, the program we hoped would create more access to the insurance, health insurance markets, adding 10 new waivers, 140 different plans. I don't know what we're talking about. Maybe 200, maybe 300 people. If you're lucky, you might be 1,000 people that are involved on some of this, which is when you're talking about 600,000 people in Oregon without health benefits, without health coverage of any kind. This is we're at the point of the triage not working here, and my concern is, and I'm going to ask specifically, Joel, would you, through the insurance division, look favorably upon a pilot program, a pilot project, for perhaps those six counties in Oregon with the highest percentages of Oregon's uninsured, such that maybe we could add some real waivers and carrier flexibility in those counties. And I brought, it's been the 2001 session, I think, that I brought to the issue. It was at 2001, we were still on a fairly even incline to return back to the amounts of uninsured that we've got today. We didn't do anything with it. 2003, I think we were trying to get ahead of it, and it doesn't appear that we have. But I'm specifically asking if we could get the support of your division for a pilot program where I can go ahead right now My constituents, and I represent two of the highest uninsured counties, percentage-wise, in the state, Baker and Mount Hare County. My concern is, if we could have a pilot program for those folks to have some flexibility, to have some waivers, so that, and I have businesses lined up, willing to pay for insurance, but are stopped by the insurance agency because of the insurance division of the state, because the programs are so inflexible, because they cannot provide the insurance that's necessary. And what I'm asking you is for your support in coming forward with some kind of a pilot program, and I'll work with AOI and others that have an interest in this, to see if we can't come forward with programs with sufficient flexibility that I can remove those counties that are in the highest 6% brackets of uninsured and give them some true flexibility so they can start to add some insurance to those folks. I don't want you to tell me no. I want you to say, here's the way we can get to yes. Would you be willing to work with us on pilot programs so that we can start pulling those people out of the 25-26% uninsured and maybe move those closer to the state average?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I won't say no. I will say yes. We were always willing to work with you and other legislators on creating the flexibility if it will help improve the insurance marketplace. And you and I have dealt on some of these issues in the past, and I very much appreciated your constructive approach to these issues. Having said that, let me say a couple other things. The legislature in 2003 really did try to wrestle with how much of this is the result of regulatory burdens and what can we do with those regulatory burdens. And they passed several initiatives. The ones I'm talking about today in the regulated market, which include these waivers and choice of plans, and in the group market, which I think is more what you're talking about, in the group market relaxing the rate bands so that there would be more flexibility to attract younger groups. So those reforms were put in after careful and long, painstaking debate, and as you well know, there are many sides to these equations when we get into the discussion, and there's some argument that some of these reforms will actually cause more uninsurance because the people who are going to get the higher rates under relaxed rate bands will fall off the market more than will attract new voters, new applicants. And all of these things are difficult, but the legislature's point here is the legislature did make some decisions. They also, as you'll hear in a few minutes, went in, a very innovative way in terms of trying to create a low-cost plan, and Administrator King will speak to that in a few minutes. So that's another reform on the table. The private market is doing a lot of constructive work in the area of consumer, what they call consumer-driven health care is another option. So the answer is yes, we're happy to work, but more or less what was decided in the 2003 session was, let's try these reforms for 4 years, let's see how these work, and rather than make other precipitous changes in the marketplace, wait on those results. So that was, again, each legislative session can make its own decisions, but that's what was decided in the 2003 session. And final comment I'll make is that, again, in my experience of these discussions is that a lot of the fire and frustration with health care double-digit rate increases gets aimed at the regulator and at the insurance companies. But if you look around, whether people are in self-insurance plans or in regulated plans, they're still tending to get about the same level of rate increases. And if you look at Oregon compared to other states, similar kinds of dynamics. Sometimes Oregon's a little higher, sometimes a little lower. So these are broader problems, and I'm not sure how much more the problem really rests on the notion that if we just relax some regulatory barriers, that would solve these problems. They have many different origins of problems, too.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Joel, what I'm after is what we're talking about is picking out the highest percentage of uninsured counties, one in six counties in the state. I think there's four that exceed 25% right now.
four or five counties, and obviously those would be amongst those six counties. I received a call, that's one of the reasons I was late to committee this morning, received a call from a farm family saying that they're going to give small raises to everyone on the farm and drop insurance coverage for everybody else. Drop all insurance coverage. The problem is that they have to cover short-term, seasonal, and temporary employees with the same coverage that they have the long-term people that live on the farms that manage and so forth. The concern I've got is that what it's going to do, of course, is gives everybody a small increase in their compensation, and then leaves probably 50 to 75 more people on or without insurance, and that's on top of the fact that I lost 700 jobs this past weekend in my district in the sugar business, and when Amalgamated Sugar shut its doors. Which is probably going to put us closer to the 30% of uninsured of any county in the state of Oregon. Madera County would then be the highest. My concern is that if I can't come in with a program that's flexible, that would be available for the non-seasonal employees, for the long-term employees, for those who are full-time and not short-term employees, and offer them the same program year after year, then what happens is that they're just moving to the roles of the uninsured. I received a second call this morning. I actually made a call to some folks who said no, that they had dropped their insurance coverage on their accountants in their office, as a CPA office. They dropped it. Actually, they just said they have offices in Oregon and Idaho. They kept it for them in Idaho and dropped it in Oregon because they don't have the flexibility in Oregon to continue with their staff. So they gave everybody in Oregon a small raise, said, go find your own insurance. Good luck. So I'm very anxious about those kinds of lack of flexibility for folks. Again, I have appreciated you working with me, but I'm saying, Joe, that the indication, when you see the numbers spike the way that they are, the indication that the triage that we're working with right now, the experimental programs that 10 waivers have actually come in for, those kinds of things, they don't appear to be working. And I'm just asking for a very dynamic, proactive program, be a pilot program, and I need your assistance and support, and look forward to your assistance and support. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we're certainly happy to work with you on any of these matters that we're discussing.
Thank you. Representative Greenleck.
Thank you. I know you need to be out of here by 9. Let me, if I may, ask a couple of questions. There is some interest on the part of some of my constituents on creating a more transparent and perhaps more regulated health insurance market. You've noted that you're covering 500,000 of the 3.5 million lives in Oregon. Do you sense a way to make your process more transparent and more obvious to folks, particularly when it comes to the question of rate increases?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenleck, excellent question. I think the answer is yes. We continually try to make it more transparent and have now on our web page detailed disclosure of rates by region of the country, by carrier, with some of the basic options available in the small group market and in the portability market where we can compare products easily. We will continue to try to make more of that transparency available. I think in a broader sense, as you've seen in the last part of my testimony this morning, I think with consumer-driven health care as a new choice of the insurers to try to control costs, have the consumer have more skin in the game, that transparency becomes absolutely vital for that reason, too. If somebody's going to have a high deductible plan and be spending out of pocket for some of their basic health care, and the theory of that is that they're going to be wiser about how they spend their dollars and so forth, they need to have accurate information about price in the marketplace. And most of the time when you start giving people accurate price information in the healthcare market, they also want to know something about quality, so you end up having quality and cost information being important to people. There's some developments in that direction. I expect you'll see bills this session to try to push that process along, particularly with the hospitals. So that kind of transparency is important as well. But I I think, yes, there's no question but that, you know, in a market system, transparency in as many different levels as possible is important. And the healthcare system, as you well know, doesn't do real well measured up against a transparency standard.
Let me follow, sir. Yeah, I had a story before I asked the second question of a person who had to pay 15% of a knee surgery. And the doctor said, well, you can go to hospital A or hospital B. It's the same. They're both good. So the person tried to find out how much it would cost for those two, for the surgery in those two, what would be the hospital component of that, that they were going to have to pay 15% of, and could not find out, couldn't get a clue as to what that might be. Could you, for a second question I have for you, sir, is could you talk about the role of ERISA and how it, what constraints ERISA puts on us in terms of our ability to regulate what's commonly known as health insurance, although it's obvious, as you point out, more than health insurance. I mean, where are our, how does ERISA really limit us in our ability to do some things about improving the insurance market
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenlake, ERISA is an extremely complicated area of law, so I hesitate to get too far into the details here, both because I'll probably bore you, and second, I'll probably make a mistake. It's just an extremely complicated area, but I will, on a one-to-one basis, get more into the details with you, but I'll give you a couple of general guidelines about ERISA. The first one I always use to explain how complicated this is, the last time Congress changed the law around these issues, which is part of the HIPAA law in 1996, the staff report to the Senate said that our intent in the ERISA sections was, quote-unquote, to preserve the current ambiguity in the statutes. That's literally how the Congress described what they were trying to do, preserve the current ambiguity in these statutes. And the ambiguity is around when insurance regulation can reach so-called ERISA plans, which are basically any employer-based coverage is likely to be an ERISA plan.
Anything an employer buys for its employees.
Yes. So something like 2 million lives in Oregon are probably covered by ERISA plans, so to speak. Now, if the employer in this ERISA plan buys insurance, then generally that's a group product that we can regulate. But because it's an ERISA plan, there are some limitations on that, and more limitations if the employer instead, quote-unquote, self-insures. The line between insurance and self-insurance can be pretty thin at times, too. But if there's self-insurance, then it's very difficult for us in a regulatory way to reach those kind of plans. There's a ton of case law about what is and isn't an appropriate type of regulation and when they can and can't reach certain kinds of ERISA employees. And if you look at that around the country, the judges basically don't figure it out real well either, because it depends on what district you're in around the United States as to whether this is the rule or that is the rule. So if you have some more specific questions, I would be happy to answer them. But essentially, for your purposes, I think the main way that ERISA affects things is for self-insured plans. It's very hard for the regulatory developments, mandates, and those sorts of things to reach those plans. They generally cannot reach those plans. And so each time there's a proposal to do some kind of regulatory intervention into the market, you will hear, with some amount of credibility, the argument from some folks that if you do that, it will be an inducement for more people to come out of the insurance ranks and go to the self-insurance ranks. And insofar as we don't collect no real clear data on that, it's always a dispute going back and forth without a lot of clear data as to what those trends are.
Mr. Chair, I suspect we are going to be hearing more about ERISA as we talk about insurance reform, because it's really not possible to try and expand employment-based health insurance without bumping into the question of how far can you do things. I think even in such issues as Representative Butler's been raising, because of this sort of cloud of ambiguous ERISA, it may be ambiguous, but it's a force, a major force.
Mr. Chair, my constituents think that ERISA means every ridiculous idea since Adam. and I think most of them are incorporated in the ERISA Act.
Well, and we don't have much to do about that. We don't have much to say over it. Yeah. That's the problem.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you being here this morning. And can I ask you to do one thing for me? If you could forward this committee a list of mandates and those that are set to expire in the next few years, the next few sessions, so that I could have something to see the landscape on that. Does that request make sense?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does make sense, and we've developed those things in the past, and it will be very easy to provide an updated list to the committee on that.
Great. Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair, I applaud your sensitivity in that regard, and I appreciate that. I would hope that maybe if we could flush out a pilot program in conjunction with the insurance division, that perhaps we could even have a committee bill that would allow. I'm just looking at those new businesses to Oregon that aren't here now, or those businesses who aren't offering any insurance coverage as of January 1st, 2005, to see if we can't get those folks back into the program to offer the insurance, and to examine the set of requirements that they must, the hoops that they have to dance through. And if we could do that, I would certainly appreciate some thoughtfulness in that regard, to see if we can't jumpstart and try and get ahead of this curve that is, it's moving Oregon quickly off the charts, unfortunately. And I don't know where we stand nationwide, but 1 in 16 certainly sounds like, or 1 in 6, 16-17%, certainly sounds like a high number of uninsured.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Thanks for sharing.
Okay, the rest of my testimony, I leave you with the written version of it, and I'd be happy to come back and answer questions at some point.
Yeah, you know, I was just trying to be sensitive to your time. I understand that you have to be somewhere else, but if you want to take a few minutes to wrap it up, it's up to you. I'll leave it up to you.
Mr. Chairman, I think I can wrap it up pretty quickly.
Okay.
Here. The couple points that I draw your attention to in the testimony are that, again, we have these reforms going forward. We have another reform in the small group market, which relaxes the rate bans. That one is being used, and so far, and this may speak, Representative Butler, some of your issues, so far that particular reform isn't resulting in an expansion of coverage. Presumably, everybody who comes in because of the relaxation over here, somebody falls off the other side. So there are. That's at that this point, we can't say that either of the reforms is working. But again, we have another biennium to try them and see if they will. A couple things that are a little more encouraging. If you look at the number of lives in our individual market and small group market, they're basically stabilized. So these markets are not diminishing in size. The small group market was down as low. The individual market was down as low as 170,000 lives a few years ago. Now it's back up to 200,000 lives, which is basically as large as that market's been. And the small group market was down as low as 240,000 lives. Now it's up about 10,000 to 250,000. So the markets, again, there are both things to lose and things to gain if we go into these markets and re-regulate them. And then again, I want to emphasize, and again, Rocky will speak to this in more detail, but the legislature did adopt yet another reform, which I think very much speaks to Representative Butler, to some of what you're saying, which is a low-cost plan that does kind of cut through some of these issues that you're describing, to offer coverage in a streamlined way that may very well be responsive. The last comment I'll make in this general area is that when I compare our state to our neighbor to the north, what you've seen in the state of Washington is a lot of gyration in their regulation of these marketplaces. They were ahead of us in the mid 90s by going to guaranteed issue in the individual market, very aggressive forms of regulation. That didn't work very well for them, so they went back to lesser regulation than us, and they've kind of been up and down. And we've, I think, in my 10 years here, we've had the experience of trying to very steadily move the market, not make major changes either for more regulation or for less regulation, but keep it as stable as possible. And I think it's served us well. So my general perspective would be to caution against, you know, radical changes on either side of the equation here without knowing exactly how they might come out. The last comments are that we've now gone from the era of managed care as the kind of cost control weapon of choice for the insurance industry to the, what the industry calls consumer-driven health care, and you'll hear a lot about that these days. From our perspective, the jury's still out on that. It may end up being a very important and effective way to control costs in the insurance marketplace. It could also end up basically appealing to the younger and healthier workers and not others. It may lead to better choices in the market, or it could simply lead to a cost shift. But the one thing we can say about consumer-driven health care, I think, is the point that Representative Greenlick and I were talking about, which is it does put an emphasis on transparency, and I would encourage this legislature to look very carefully at the issue of how do we create more transparency from the insurance regulator's perspective, as you point out, as well as from the carrier's perspective, as well as from the provider's perspective. I think all of that very important work if consumer-driven health care is to deliver on its promise. With that, I'll conclude. I take a final question if anybody has them.
Thank you very much. In looking at your materials, it seems that what causes the cost to go up, all kinds of things, but one of them you didn't mention is the mandates. So when you do give us the information that will be following up this presentation this morning, could you talk about how much the mandates that Oregon requires, how much that drives the cost, and what other issues do provide the cost driver to rise?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, we can elaborate on some of our comments. Most of the cost drivers are elsewhere than the mandates, but they certainly add something to the cost
sure.
of health care.
And what they add, I would appreciate knowing.
Okay.
Thank you.
If you could also bring back some kind of document that's graphing the stability of the various healthcare marketplaces you were describing to show us you know, what it's looked like in the past few years, and also how that has been affected by population change and things like that.
Mr. Chair, we certainly can do that as well.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your comments on consumer-driven health care. I have a bill just kind of as a placekeeper on HSAs, and I don't know whether you want to come in, and I'm sure we're going to hear more from Ms. Trussell and Mr. Wilson and others in the future, but I would really like, maybe not at this point, but sometime down the line, how the division looks on HSAs and how that interfaces with the federal government and what they're encouraging in terms of health savings. And this might be an area where Representative Butler's suggestion might be put into place where we do try a pilot really encouraging consumer-driven health care. My county would certainly prosper by having a lot more coverage than we do, and we're not getting it. So any way we can kickstart that and get a lot more people in, and encouraging the American people and the people of Oregon to save for their own health. That government can't produce everything for you, and the more we can encourage them to save that money that'll take over when they have medical care costs that can't be covered by the deductible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'd be happy to work with you on that issue as well. Our role in that primarily is to approve more large deductible plans that are then paired with this health savings accounts, which are generally outside of our regulation. They're more tax-related vehicles, but the underlying high deductible plans that come with the HSAs, we do regulate, and we have shown a very flexible perspective on approving those kinds of products so that to the extent there are Oregonians who want that kind of high deductible plan, it is available from a regulatory perspective.
Do you have some information on that? Yes, I had a curiosity in what those plans look like, but I really haven't had a chance to research them. Do you have some information about what a HSA with a high deductible catastrophic plan would look like?
Mr. Chair, yes, we do.
Yeah, great, thanks. I think we have to move on, but I appreciate you being here. And
thank you.
And if members, if you have further questions, I encourage you to contact Mr. Arroyo directly, and we could have Mr. Arroyo back if some other issues come up. So appreciate you being here today. Next, I think we will move on to a presentation from the Insurance Pool Governing Board with Rocky King, the administrator. Representative Butler, I have, this is sort of on a side note while Mr. King is getting ready. I just want to tell you how much I appreciate how hard you work and for the people in your district and how much you deeply care about the constituents you serve. I've watched you over the three sessions that I've been in this building, too, as a legislator, but I would be hard-pressed to find somebody who cares more about those folks out there in Eastern Oregon than you do. And it's just, it is an inspiration, I think, to all of us. But I know times are tough. I know that the sugar plant was a real serious blow to that community. I've been out to NISA. I've seen the plant. So I know what you're talking about. And I appreciate everything that you're doing to help those folks, whether it's trying to figure out some sort of health insurance that's affordable, although nothing's affordable when you don't have a job, right?
Right.
But I appreciate you, and I look forward to seeing what you come up with.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
Chair. I appreciate your consideration.
Mr. King, good morning.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, which is the state's high-risk health insurance pool, and also the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which administers the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, as well as the new certified plans we'll be talking about today, often under House Bill 2537. I've given you a packet of information, and the first thing, I want to just kind of let you know what's there. Representative Tomei, you asked for some information on mandates,
mm-hmm.
and I've provided you an analysis of group health insurance mandates, which lists out all of the insurance mandates contained within the Oregon Code. We do not have the cost information of this. We don't have the ability to get that, but the Insurance Division has some information relative to those costs, I think, that Joel will have sent over to you. When I get to the certified plans, we also have a smaller version of the mandate page or paper that speaks to some of the mandates that were included and a few that were excluded from the certified plans. But that was just kind of in response, Representative Tomei, to your question. So I hope that will help provide some information. And if you'd like me to come back, it's about an hour presentation. But we have a staff member that is pretty knowledgeable about the mandate and can go through them with you. I'd like to start off today, if I may, with what we call the egg. Some people call it the broken egg, and it's been around since about 1990, and people keep saying use it because it's pretty easy to understand. You know, when people talk about the Oregon Health Plan and the initiatives that we started way back in 1987, a lot of people think of it in terms of Medicaid. But the Oregon Health Plan has always been a larger concept than just the Medicaid program. And I think the egg diagram before you, and I'm just going to walk through it really quickly. It's kind of a history of 101 on the Oregon Health Plan. But it kind of tells you of all the different initiatives that the state, the legislature, and the governors that we've had over the last 15 years have really put their money, time, and effort in to try to get people insured. The first one at the top and right in the middle is the employer pay or play health insurance mandate. It was enacted in 1987, and it basically provided a target number of people that had to get insured, and if the state didn't insure those people, an employer mandate would actually kick in, requiring all employers to provide a certain level of health care benefits to their employees and their dependents, and if they chose not to, they would have to pay through the tax system into a pool so that those people could get insurance. Getting back to Representative Greenlick, that unfortunately is just the opposite of what ERISA says a state can do. ERISA basically says that a state cannot regulate an employer in the provision of health insurance benefits. They can regulate insurance companies, but not the employer. So while everybody knew that it probably couldn't get through ERISA, it really was hanging out there as kind of a carrot, or I should say maybe a paddle, to try to get businesses to step up to the plate and more of them offer health insurance benefits. It was phased out in 1996 based on legislation passed in 1993 that said if you just don't go get an ERISA exemption from the federal government, then we're going to go ahead and phase it out. ERISA doesn't have a process to get an exemption. There is no waiver process. So it was more words than it was action. On the left-hand side, there were the small employer health plans started by the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which were tied to that mandate that we started in 1989. Basically, we had a $53.33 benefit package we offered to small businesses that had not been insured for a period of 1 year. And they said, go out and get a whole bunch of new folks. Our uninsurance rate's 18%. Let's see if we can get some of these businesses to step up to the plate. Between 1989 and 1996, at the height, we had 30,000 or 33,005 employees and dependents enrolled in small certified plans by the IPGB. During that 11-year, 12-year period, we had over 60,000 employees and dependents enrolled at one time with about 20,000 employers involved. We were truly dealing with the small, what we call mom-and-pop businesses, two, three employees. But it was their first time to really get into the group market. But 1998, things in this state were pretty good. You know, we had insurance rates down to 11% for all Oregonians, about 8% for children. So we made a decision that with all the insurance market reforms, we would phase out the Insurance Pool Governing Board programs.
The uninsured rate, is that what you're...
Mr. Chair, sorry.
The uninsured rate was down to...
The uninsured rate, excuse me, was down to 11% all Oregonians, about 8 to 9% for children. So we decided in 1998, because things were going so well, everybody had access, inflation was low. We had managed care was at its height between 96 and 98. So we made a decision in the 1999 legislative session to phase out the IPGB certified plans. That may or may not have been a mistake. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. But by the year 2000, we had phased out that program and all those folks had gone to the regular market. In 1990, if you were working for someone who didn't provide group coverage and you had diabetes, you had cancer, you had a mental health illness, you were taking prescriptions, you had asthma, you couldn't get health insurance. You were denied it because of a pre-existing condition. So the state in 1989 passed legislation that set the high-risk health insurance pool into motion. And basically, we have two charges. One is to provide access to those denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions. And number two, we provide an option for those people leaving group coverage who may not have a portability option available through their carrier. They move out of the service district. They're in a self-insured plan where there is no portability option. And we provide portability benefits to those people that, again, can't get coverage anyplace else. Let me talk a little bit about the high-risk pool. First of all, we have about 10,200 individuals enrolled in the pool as of last month. The average age is about 50 years old. 60% are female. We're talking about health conditions that run from cancer, heart disease, HIV, AIDS, almost anything you can name. We've got somebody in the pool that has it. These are very expensive chronic care individuals who are denied coverage in the marketplace, and thus OMIP is their only option. Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Why is, in the high-risk pool, why is the greatest percentage of participation female? 60%, you said.
Representative Delto, I believe it's because of the lack of group coverage. It's very often available. Very often you're talking about dependents. And if we look at one of the things I was going to talk about, some of the insurance statistics, if you look at over the last two or three years, 49% of small businesses were offering dependent coverage. That figure, according to Bruce Goldberg at the Office of Health Policy, has dropped to almost 29%. So what you see is a lot of dependents, and those are primarily going to be female, very often are just denied any access through the group market, so the individual market is their only option.
Can I just ask a tangential question? What does it look like, the breakdown between gender in the overall organs overall and insured population. You may not have that information.
Mr. Chair, I would not have those figures. Okay. I just don't know.
Who would have that? In the insurance division, you think?
No, I think Bruce might have it from the survey we do each year.
Okay. From the organ population survey, Mr. Chair, they may have that information. We can check with
okay.
them.
I'll ask. Thank you.
Okay. So the high-risk pool, offers the coverage to these folks with pre-existing conditions. We offer four benefit plans with varying deductibles, starting at $500 all the way up to a $2,500 deductible plan. Premiums are established based on the regular market. Every year we do a survey to determine what the private insurance industry is charging folks in their individual market. The board has authority to go to 125% of what is called then that standard rate. So we look at a benefit package in the commercial market. We look at ours. We make some adjustments because of maybe some benefit differences. Ours actually have a little bit better benefit very often than the individual market because we have state-mandated mental health benefits in our OMIP package. And then they are able to add some sort of surcharge to that. Currently, we're about, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this gets to your question, to Joel, we're about 111% of the standard rate for those that come into the pool on a medical eligibility. For the portability folks, we are at 100% of standard. In other words, we provide no surcharge to those people who come in under the portability eligibility into the pool. Board,
can I stop you there?
Yes.
So what would be the typical rate then at 111% for high risk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, if you go into, I'm not even sure what color this is, but if you go in, there's two. One is the health benefit plan summary, and the other is the premium rate.
Great.
And if you open that up and you look at, for example, a $500 deductible plan, will range anywhere from 183 for an individual up to 445 for somebody 60 years and above.
Got it. Okay, that's great. Thanks so much.
If you look at then the down to the $1,500, I said $2,500, excuse me, I meant $1,500 deductible, it ranges from $128 to $311. And if you take about 10 to 15% off of each one of these prices, you'll get a good picture of what they pay for in the commercial market. So we're not much different. Now, it doesn't take anybody very long to figure out if you're a 50-year-old female, for example, let's say you're single, living by yourself, earning $2,000 a month, that all of a sudden you are paying $400 or $500 a month for health insurance premiums, plus your co-pays and your deductibles. It is very difficult for people to afford health insurance today, let alone those with chronic health conditions. Mr. Chair?
Is the access to the OMIP pool pretty free? In other words, can somebody decide that they want to join this pool, or are there limitations about how big the pool is?
No, Mr. Chair, there's really a couple eligibility. First of all, the board has always taken the position since 1991 that they will take all comers. That is, anybody that meets the eligibility, they will let them in. They do not close enrollment since 1991. And the only reason we did back then is we had some limited funding at that point. If you are denied health insurance because of health conditions, don't have group coverage available to you, resident of Oregon, obviously, then you're going to be able to get into the pool if you can afford the premiums. And I can talk about FEOP in a few minutes, which helps about 1,500 of those folks get in there. Portability coverage, if you don't have a portability option with either Blue Cross, ODS, Kaiser, Providence Health Plans, you move out of the service district from one carrier to another, or you come in from out of state into Oregon and don't have and leaving group coverage and don't have portability available to you, you can get into the pool. There are no limitations in terms of enrollment as long as you meet the eligibility requirements. And that does create some problems, though. First of all, the premiums that we collect, even though they're at set at 111%, only cover about 60 to 65% of the pool expenses. For every dollar we expend in or receive in premiums, we spend about $1.60 in claims, $1.60 to $1.65. Where do we get that other 65 cents? We basically assess all insurers that have lives enrolled in the state of Oregon. Annually, we do a count through the carriers to determine how many people are covered through them. It's about 1.8, 1.9 million. This is not the self-insured, only through a carrier or those that purchase stop-loss coverage if they're self-insured. And we look at what our losses are for that for the next 6 months. We divide it up based on the enrollment that a particular carrier has. If they have 25% of the enrollment and we have $10,000 in losses, they're going to pay $2,500. So we assess those carriers every 6 months. Our last assessment was about $15 million. For the last, this current biennium, we will assess carriers for operation of the health insurance pool about $50 million. And that's down from about $53 million from the previous biennium, but it is still a hefty amount. If you have insurance today for yourself, you're for the next 6 months, $1.52 of your insurance premium is going to help support those people that are enrolled in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. That's about the cost on average per person enrolled in the state.
So an additional cost shift.
Explicit. But additional, you're right, Mr. Chair.
And is there a point at which, you know, you start to enroll people in the OMIP program that the insurers start to get cranky about the level of assessment that they're being that they're being imposed?
Mr. Chair, I've been the administrator for the pool since 1990, and I can tell you there has been 14 years of straight crankiness at times on the assessment. You know, let me speak to that a little bit. The primary reason you have a high-risk pool is to provide access, but just as important is to provide for a stable individual market. The legislature, in their wisdom, could say, we're going to have guaranteed issue in the individual market. We're not going to force those people with chronic illnesses to go into the pool. The problem with that is if every one of those individuals went to ODS health plans, for example, it would put them under. It would drive the rates so high that they couldn't afford to provide for an individual plan. Or if they all ended up at Blue Cross Blue Shield, or if they all ended up at PacifiCare. The idea of the pool is to be able to spread the risk of those people to the largest population possible. So while the carriers, I think, you know, no one likes the assessment, but the other side of that is the alternative, a individual market and guaranteed issue, would probably destroy the individual market over the long haul. And we've seen that, what happened in the state of Washington. It pushed the rates up in the individual market to the point people couldn't afford them, because you're spreading it over just a smaller group of people in the individual market, 200,000, as opposed to 2 million people. The other thing is the OMIP board is made up of 9 members. Two of those are consumer advocates, the director of the Department of Consumer Business Services. We have also a provider on it, but then 5 representatives from the insurance industry. So we have the majority of the board members do represent the insurance industry and do support and the assessment, and are the ones that establish and vote on that assessment every 6 months.
Thanks. Representative Anderson.
My question was, thank you, Mr. Chair. The $1.52 that you mentioned, Rocky, is that a $1.52 extra on your month, on your year, on over what?
Yeah, Representative Dalto, Representative Anderson, that's $1.52 per month per member enrolled in a health plan through a carrier.
So it's on your premium every month.
And it's included in the premium. And Representative Anderson, if you look at large groups, for example, I'm on the PEB board, and when we get our bids once a year from the carriers, you'll see on there, there will be portability charges, because the portability costs money. There will be an OMIP assessment charge. So that basically gets passed on, as everything does, throughout the market. But again, it's spread to the largest group of people, 1.9 million, that is possible for us to spread it to.
Segue question, Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you. Rocky, could you give us some sort of a history on the $1.52? Has it been going up? Has it been coming down? Is there, and I was looking through your other information here to see if perhaps you've given us
some kind of a history of that cost share.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, our three-year average is $1.26, so it's a little bit higher. I can, again, that's this last assessment. Our assessment for the two-year current biennium is about $50 million. Last biennium, it was about $53 million. So the price has been pretty stable for the last 3 or 4 years, probably going between $1 and $1.52. In 1997, I think, or 98, when we first implemented FEOP, we thought that we were going to see a large influx of folks into it. I think we spiked up to $1.92. Then we dropped down to 90 cents. It's all based on losses. And losses are, so you have a loss ratio, and we're at about 160%. The second thing it's based on is just membership. We had about a year and a half ago, we had about 10,200, and because price of all the price increases of all of our plans, we saw about 700 or 800 people dropped from the pool, so our assessment went down a little bit and was only like $10 million, I think, the previous 6 months. But as we see population going up, then we're going to see the assessment continue to go up.
Thank you.
Representative Butler, I will provide you with a stat pack that gives you a 15-year history on that.
I would appreciate that. Thank you for all members, if I may, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You just slipped something by me a moment that tweaked my interest. When a self-insured plan buys stop-loss coverage, then you have the ability, then it becomes the insurance and it comes outside of the ERISA exclusion, and you have the ability to...
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, the assessment can be made against health insurers and those that provide either reinsurance or stop-loss coverage. We also, in our statute, have the authority to assess totally self-insured employers, but that's against ERISA, so we've never tried to do that. So basically, if a large business self-insures, that is, basically they're carrying their own risk, running their own plan, they contract with somebody who has a network, but they take the risk. They very often will then go to a reinsurer who says, you know, if something happens above $1 million for somebody, we'll cover that. So that reinsurer is providing either an individual or an overall aggregate reinsurance plan for that business. We're able to assess on the basis of the number of lives that that reinsurance contract covers. So that was something that was very controversial back in 1989 when it was passed. We were sued in both federal and state court by Safeco, a reinsurer, and prevailed in both federal and state court to continue that as along with the regular health insurers as a part of our funding base.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, okay, let's see where we are here. Let me talk a little bit about the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. It was started in basically 1998, and where it kind of came from was there was a whole bunch of folks out there, and we had been expanding Medicaid, but there was a whole bunch of folks out there that were working full-time, that were carrying on, earning their normal livings, helping support through the taxes, people enrolled in Medicaid, people enrolled in Medicare, yet they themselves couldn't afford health insurance. And I mean, if you got somebody that's taking home $2,200 or $2,400 a month and has a family of three, and then going to them and saying, and by the way, to purchase health insurance because you're not eligible for Medicaid, you're not eligible for Medicare, your group coverage is not available to you. So if you would like to pay $700-$800 a month to cover your family, you can do so. The reality is, folks couldn't do that. And there were about 130,000 to 135,000 people between 100 and 200% of poverty that just couldn't prevent or purchase their health insurance. So the legislature passed FEOP, state-funded only, and said go out and do great things and give an opportunity to these low-income working Oregonians, give them an opportunity to purchase health insurance. The problem was, starting in 1999, 2001, 2003, we really had some really state fiscal budget crisis going on. So we originally were allocated 15,000. We opened up the door, got to about 7,400. People said close it, cut the budget in the next session in 99, and you're down to 4,000. 2001, they cut you out of the budget, so you've been putting people out. Last day of the session, you come in. It was very, very difficult to maintain any kind of stability of enrollment, any tie, any kind of relationship with employers, because you never knew whether you were going to be there 1 year or not the next. But in 2001, the legislature passed a bill that basically directed DHS to go to the federal government. It's called the Oregon Health Plan Waivers 2, OHP 2, and to see if we could get some federal funds to help expand the FEOP program. And that came into fruition in I think 2002, that allowed FEOP to utilize federal dollars and to expand. But the legislature at that same time said, please do so only in the group market. Try to get a balance between how many people you have in group and how many people you have in the individual market. At that point, we had very few in the group, had 3,000 or 4,000 in the individual market, so we closed the individual market until group could catch up. We were trying to do that at the same time the economy was going in the tubes, the same time employers were dropping coverage, not adding coverage, and it has been very, very difficult to build up the group market. It continues to grow. We were down to as low as, I think, 600 or 700 individuals enrolled through their group employers, but now we're at about 4,000, but it's a very, very slow growth. And let me tell you a little bit about FEOP and what it does. I know I'm cognizant of the time here, but FEOP will subsidize the premiums for purchase of private health insurance in either the group or individual market. You must have been uninsured for 6 months and have income under 185% and assets less than $10,000. These are generally the working Oregonians. If you're working 40 hours a week minimum wage, you're at about 110-120% of poverty level. You're not below poverty level, you're just above it. We were trying to focus on really those folks. So you're a resident of Oregon, you've got group health insurance or individual health insurance available to you, we will subsidize anywhere from 50% to 95% of the premium available to you to go out and purchase private health insurance. If it's a group market, we look at the plan offered by the group or by the employer. If it meets a benchmark established by the federal government, you sign up, send us your wage stub once a week, once a month, every 2 weeks, and we will reimburse you for your share of that premium. Individual markets, a little different. We give them a certificate of coverage that says they're eligible. They go to Blue Cross or ODS or to Kaiser or whichever small or individual market carrier we have in the state that we've certified, sign up for any one of their plans, and we will again set up a billing arrangement where we pay the carrier directly and bill you just for that share of the premium that you're responsible for. The best way to see that, I think, is on page 15 of, it's called the agency overview. It's not 15, it's on, 15. Called the agency overview. And you can see the premiums or the subsidy levels on the bottom of page 15, up to 125%, we pay 95, then 90 for the next 25%, all the way down to 50%. What that means in income, you can see on the next page. So somebody, for example, a family of four that earns about $2,000 a month is eligible for a 90% subsidy to purchase private health insurance, whether that be group market or whether that be individual market. About July of this last year, we went to the governor and basically said that group was going very slow, that we wanted to open that up more to the individual market. And based on legislation passed last session, we were given more flexibility to do that. So since July, we have been actively marketing to both the individual and group market. We have now about 8,500 folks that are enrolled in this program, another 2,500 that have been approved over the last month or two that are out there trying to get insurance now, and have almost 2,000 lives, or about 1,000 families, and we figure usually two per family, that are attempting to get the subsidy by having an application in-house that we're currently processing.
Chair.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many people could you go to under the present funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, currently we could serve between 16 and 18,000, and we're actively out there marketing that program, too. I'd like to get to a question that Representative Butler mentioned earlier. Give an example of some of the things we're doing. John Day, which I think is your district, we went out to work with the local schools and signed up 80 families by when they do the opening of schools, where they bring all the families together. We took out eligibility folks and applications and actually signed up 80 families. We just got back from the Dalles last month, where teaming up with the local hospital and the chamber, we put on an uninsurance day. We rented a hall, rented a Xerox machine, five tables. We only have one office. We're not statewide. Brought up a whole bunch of eligibility workers, brought food, and sat there and signed up approximately 200, I think it was 100 families, 250 individuals into the FIAT program. Over the next month, we're going to be training in, next month and a half, John Day, Klamath Falls, Lakeview, Ontario, Pendleton, LeGrand, Redmond, the Dalles, Bend, Brookings, Canningville, and Coos Bay, as well as all the ones you always hear about, Medford, Roseburg, Salem, Eugene, 25 locations, 21 different cities around FIAT, Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and the new certified plans. So there are some things that we're trying to do to get out to local communities. We're hoping over the next year that every school child in the state will get a brochure about FIAT through the school. Let me tell you a little bit about who's enrolled.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Greenlake.
Yep. Is there a close link between FIAT for those kids and the CHIP program?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, children under 185%, assuming they're not Medicaid eligible, they're under 6 years old, have the option of both FIOP and CHIP. And as you know, CHIP is open. It has no cap on it at this point. FIOP serves, for children, basically that same population. In our group market, about 50% of our enrollment are children. Now, these are families that could put their kids into Medicaid CHIP, but choose to keep them instead in a group health benefit plan with one of the parents generally. And why they do that? Because with us, they have to pay a portion of the premium. They have copays and deductibles, whereas CHIP, basically, it's free for children, no copays and deductibles. Generally has to do with a couple things. One, access, that you're using a commercial card, a Blue Cross card, a Kaiser card. You get to go basically to the carriers that you've signed up to go see. Secondly is just the stigma. People prefer sometimes not to have the Medicaid card. They would rather have, again, a commercial insurance card. I think the third just may be that keeping your families together in the same insurance plan, as opposed to having somebody on Medicaid, somebody on a commercial, just keeping them in one plan has made a difference. I don't know if that...
May I just call for a moment? But the information, you have the information for both simultaneously. Is that...
Yes.
I mean, that's what I was asking.
Yes.
So that,
yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake.
They have a knowledge. I mean, they have an intelligent decision on that.
All of our application material point out all the options, whether it's CHIP, Medicaid, whatever it is. Any acceptance letter into FIOP that is sent out also reminds them that they have other options that may provide better or different or less expensive coverage to that family, and which generally means CHIP or the Medicaid program. So every family is given that information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rocky, the federal poverty level is used as a guideline for the income for those folks to participate in some of these programs. Are asset accumulations ever used? For instance, that you get someone that has their own home and that's all paid for, but that their income level is very small. What, help me with the assets versus the income.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in terms of assets, we look at liquid assets. So, for example, a retirement, or a home, or a car, or tools of the trade, or your business assets. If you, a lot of people are self-employed, just whether it's a janitorial service or whatever it may be, we only look at the liquid assets. The difference in that, though, is we will not allow, and I'm going to look at Nicole Shuba, rental property. That is counted as an asset. So if you have rental property, that's different than your primary residence. And we've set the assets higher. We're at $10,000 rather than the state Medicaid, which is $5,000, because when you look at this income level, it was in consultation with the legislature back when we started this program, we wanted people to save money. These are people with kids, and we were hoping, and a lot of people, we wanted to have the ability to put money into the bank to hopefully someday buy a home. So a little bit different assets as you move up the income ladder. Secondly, we wanted to have a period of uninsurance that was, a period enrolled in the program, which is 12 months of eligibility as opposed to 6 months. As people come off the Oregon Health Plan and come into the FEOP program, or those who just never... were in that middle and not eligible for Medicaid and came to us, we wanted to make sure that health care, quite frankly, was something that you did once a year and taken care of. We did not want people to have to make job decisions based on 50-cent increases. Somebody asked me one time, what if somebody wins the lottery and they're on FEOP and they just got FEOP? So they got 11 months to go. And my response is, I'm going to send them a letter of congratulations and say, you're going to pay more taxes than any subsidy I'm ever going to pay you. We want people to earn money. And, the limit is 185%, but if you look at this, that's not a lot of dough. So as people move up, the subsidy goes down, and eventually, hopefully, they get above the line and can afford it themselves.
Mr. Chair.
Is it pressing? Yes, Mr.
Short right. No, I pushed on you to keep moving it. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
We passed Senate Bill 875 last time, 185%. Limit for a drug purchasing pool option for folks 55 and older. Is that being integrated into the FEOP program in any way yet?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Green, no, at this point they are not one of the large purchasers because we use commercial coverage.
Yeah, that was quick.
That was,
Mr. Chair. I'd like to spend the last few 5 minutes then on the certified plans, which we can get into, and this gets to I think some of Representative Butler's questions or concerns, I should say. 2001, there was some legislation passed. I think Mary Nolan, Representative Nolan, was one of the key sponsors that basically asked the Insurance Book Governing Board to develop plans to go out and offer to previously uninsured businesses to see if we could entice them into the marketplace. There were some flaws with that legislation as it stood, so we had to wait until 2003 when we got a new bill through House Bill 2537. That basically directed the Insurance Pool Governing Board to offer uninsured businesses a benefit plan that wasn't necessarily subject to the mandates, and the whole idea was to come out there with something a little bit lower cost that could entice these businesses in to provide coverage. A lot of debate whether the mandate should be in or not, we can continue that debate today, and we probably will at some point. But the board worked very hard, and Steve Doty is the chair of the board, and we'll be talking in a few minutes. But the board worked very hard, and let me tell you what their targets were. First of all, they wanted to target the premiums of a benefit plan that were about 30% cheaper than what people could get in the regular market. You get what you pay for, which means the only way to get to that 30% is either cut benefits or cost shift some of the costs back to the consumer. And basically, they did that, and they came up with what they call an alternative group plan. I want to point out this here, and if you turn to the last page, it's the small health plan. It is a plan that is for adults lifetime maximum of $500,000. The only mandate that of any significance that's not included is mental health and chemical dependency. And I will tell you that that probably is the only mandate that really has any cost to it, and the costs aren't probably that great, but it is really only one you can, it isn't less than a percent, it's more than a percent, whether it's 4 or 5%. I think the insurance division can tell you on a macro basis better than I. We did this, though, by basically limiting some of the covered services around home health care, hospice care, rehabilitation, by putting some limits there, setting a very low annual benefit maximum the first 2 years of $50,000 for each of the 2 years, and also a fairly high deductible of about $1,000. Now, let me tell you, if you have a group of five employees that are 50 years old and very sick, they're not going to want this plan. This is really designed to try to get at that 20 to 35-year-old invincible, healthy, young worker who said, I'm not doing anything because I'm fine, because it costs too much to pay the $400 or $500 to get health insurance. So what we've tried to do is really offer something to entice those folks that are generally more healthy to get into the market by a combination of first-dollar catastrophic coverage. It's really not a catastrophic because it does have some limitations that are fairly low, but it also provides some pretty good benefits early on in terms of the physician and diagnostic hospital services, a little bit of each. But while the board did this, and we're hoping and we'll be coming out March 30 or March 1st with this, they also felt very strongly, along with the governor, that we couldn't provide the same benefit plan to kids. So we're offering what is called the Children's Group Benefit Plan in conjunction with this. So basically, if you turn to the front page or the front section, you'll see the Children's Group Plan. Much better plan in terms of the deductible, lifetime max, Rx benefits. You know, most kids take a lot of drugs, all the antibiotics, good drug benefit, good covered services. We do provide mental health, chemical dependency benefit. So what we're saying is, okay, adults, healthy folks, you know, come on in. We want to get you insured. We also want the kids, but we're not going to shortchange the kids. We're going to give them a pretty good plan. And a business has an option. They can cover only their employee. They can cover the employee and the employee spouse with the alternative plan. They can cover the employee and spouse with the alternative plan and the children with the children's plan. Or they can cover only the children with the children's plan. We've turned it upside down. We're going to employers now and saying, you know, you can't afford coverage for all your employees and their spouses and their kids, but which has a greater priority? Can we at least walk in the door and see if we can get the kids covered? So we're trying really a four-prong approach with these businesses to see if we can, again, get some of them that are uninsured into the ranks. Now, the uninsured rate for small businesses probably, and these are off the top of my head, I'd have to get the actual, but you're talking in the 50% range when you start getting to businesses under 25 employees. And a business to enroll in this plan has to have been uninsured since July of 2003 or a new business that is formed after that date. So the intent here was not to go to existing businesses that are insured and say, drop your coverage down to this level. Yep. It was really to say, if you're not insured, we want you to come under the tent and join everybody else, at least with a minimal health plan. This news conference is going to be held on Monday with the governor to announce the implementation of this March 1st. We are training all the insurance company staff this week, and next week or later this week start on a road trip to 25 cities to train. We're hoping between 1,000 and 1,200 health insurance agents. You'll start seeing at the first of the year our Bill Shonley ads and some other ads that start touting this a little bit, public service announcements on both the FIOP program as well as the certified plans. I don't know how many kids we're going to get enrolled in this. I don't know if it's going to be 10 or if it's going to be 10,000. But we're going to try this as really a model to see if it works.
Representative Fumay.
Quick one. Why was it decided not to cover dental?
Mr. Chair, Representative Termaine, in terms of the children's group plan, because I believe it was an 8 to 10% premium, and it's just one of those things that we were trying to get the premium as low as we can. And the premiums for children is no bargain. It's a good benefit package. It's going to be pretty much the same cost as it would be in a normal group plan. The only savings we were able to really generate was on the adult side. But it was simply a cost issue of, again, trying to get...
the 8 to 10% higher premium that included dental?
It was about an 8%, I believe. Do you remember, Nicole? I want to say it was between about an 8% difference in price.
Thank you.
I will get you the exact amount. I do have the exact. It's just not on the top of my head.
Thank you.
Now, we hope to combine the FEOP program with this certified plan. Now, the adults is not a subsidizable plan. The benefit is too low to go and use the state and federal dollars to subsidize it. But the children's plan does meet what is called our benchmark plan. So we will be able to go to a small business and say, if you put in at least $50 per family, we'll come in for the low-income folks and help subsidize their share of the premium. So it'll combine, really, employer dollars, state funds, federal funds, and the individual's contribution levels or contributions to the plan.
Mr. Chair.
Do I understand it right that for the adult plan, there's a $1,000 deductible per member before any of these benefits kick in?
I'm sorry.
I was looking at the deductible for the.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, if you look at the medical cost sharing, the annual deductible in network is $1,000. If you go out of network, it's $1,500.
And that's before, so that you spend $1,000 on this plan before any benefits
that
get
is,
in.
That is correct.
About $80 a month, roughly, per person.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just tried to give a two-hour speech here, a presentation in about half hour, 45 minutes. If you have any other questions, then come back. I will get some additional information to you on the assessments and some other questions that you asked.
And, you know, I would sit here and hear the whole 2 hours myself, and I just can't think of a way that we can accommodate that during the session. But I would hope that you'd be available to any of the members individually to...
Could you get a phone number, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Do we have contact information for you, Rocky? Is that here?
The general number is in the back. We have the website there, too. But let me give you my personal number, if you want to write that down, Representative Butler. It's 503-378-5165. And all of you, I think, have received an invitation to attend one of the training sessions and to actually come. We've sent those out in mail to every legislator, and I think you responded, and we're hoping that you can come. If you want to come and just for 5 or 10 minutes, welcome the people in your community or stay for the whole thing. And that is the three-hour presentation that you'll get on all of this.
But could you resend that to some of us?
I will have it faxed over to you or hand-delivered to you.
I appreciate your presentation. Very complicated issues that we could explore in great detail, which maybe some of us will do at a later time. Thank you so much. Okay, we have, we have one, two, three folks still scheduled to testify. Steve Doty with Northwest Employee Benefits, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and J.L. Wilson with the National Federation of Independent Business. And I wanted to get sort of an industry perspective on what the marketplace is looking like for employers. So we have about a half an hour to do that. So if we could keep our presentations on the next panel to, 10 minutes apiece, we'll do our best to see how we can go through those. And I apologize in advance for shortchanging the folks on the rest of the agenda, but if I could ask Steve Doty to come forward, I'd appreciate it. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Dalto and members of the committee. My name is Steve Doty. I'm an independent insurance agent in Portland, Oregon. I'm a past president of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters. I also currently serve as a member of the Health Insurance Advisory Committee, Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee, which is a committee that advises the insurance department. And I also serve as chair of the Insurance Governing Board. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Health Underwriters, which is a professional organization made of members consists of independent agents like myself and also carrier representatives from the different insurance companies. I had hoped to have another individual here with me, another one of our members who is a independent consulting actuary. He was unable to be here today, unfortunately, but I did provide two exhibits from his information that I think you might find helpful, and I'll touch on those briefly. Much of what I want to say has already been said, so I don't think I need a whole lot of time, but I do want to give a perspective of what's happening in the market from our perspective as agents, because we are the ones who are on the front line dealing with the individual employers, employer groups of all sizes, and individuals as they attempt to acquire health insurance. What I provided here and a couple of exhibits. Exhibit A, as I've identified it, is just a sample. I thought you might find it helpful. These are five small employers that just this month I put out bids for these small employers for them to acquire health insurance. I've just identified them as labeled them A through E. I've indicated the number of employees they have. They range from as small as 2 to as high as 15. So these are small employers, subject to CHI regulation. I've also indicated the average
age. What's CHI?
I'm sorry, small employer health insurance, mm-hmm. Which is the small group of legislation. I've shown indicated the average age, and the reason that's important is because that is the primary factor used in determining the rates for these small employers. I've given you a range of the bids that I receive are from seven different small employer carriers, and the type of coverage is summarized below, so you can indicate what kind of benefits they're buying, the deductibles and the co-insurances. And you can see that the premiums range from a low, for example, employer A with an average age of 53, the low premium is $370 a month to a high of $460, and the family premium was $1,038 to a high of $1,335. And if the employer were to pay all of that employee cost, just using the lower numbers, the costs are shown there on a monthly basis for employer A, for example, would be $1,850 or an annual cost of $22,000 a year. And for a small employer, these are significant costs. They sometimes represent the difference between making a profit or not, or whether this small employer takes out a salary for themselves or not. So these are significant issues. And I've also shown this Exhibit B, just to give you an idea. Again, this is Kevin McCartan's data, but to give you a comparison of the rate increases that employers are seeing as compared to the Consumer Price Index. This data is actually for some large employer groups that he provides consulting actuarial services for. Exhibit C shows the cumulative effect of that. So you can see that over time, employers, as they face rate increases of 5 to 10 to 15% every year over multiple years, they're paying 2 to 3 times as much as health insurance premiums as they have paid in the past. Because of the reforms that have been passed in the last several years, all of which we've been supportive of, we have an environment in the state of Oregon where insurance is accessible. There's no such thing as an uninsurable Oregonian. If you live in Oregon, you can buy a health insurance policy, either an individual plan, through OMIP, or through group. And we support that. I think that's a positive thing. But the problem we face right now is costs. And there are several issues that are driving the costs. One are technology advances. Technology is a wonderful thing when you're the one accessing this medical technology, but it's expensive. The other is the cost shift created by inadequate government reimbursement through Medicare and Medicaid. It's estimated that when someone receives services through these state programs, that they only reimburse between 40 and 60% of the actual cost, and that is then shifted to individuals who have private health insurance. The aging of the population, there's nothing much we can do about that, although I'd be happy to support any legislation you could present that would stop that. But malpractice costs are a problem. That's a hotly debated issue, and how much that actually impacts insurance costs is debated heatedly, but it is a cost nonetheless. increased subsidies for OMIP and portability. Rocky and Joel have both touched on that. And the legislative and regulatory impact. Anytime legislation is passed, both state and federally, it costs insurers money to comply with that. And all of those things together are what amount to the, what are driving the costs. This is what employers are doing. And some of this is just anecdotal evidence. I can only tell you what I see from my the clients I represent and from as I talk to my peers in the business and what they see. But we don't see a lot of employers dropping coverage as a result of this, which is good news. And I think that's indicated they're supported by some of the data that Joel provided as he said that the number of the number of people covered under the CHI group has actually increased. And employers are still paying a considerable amount of the premium for the employees, but they're not paying for dependents, which is another argument why we need to support FEOP, because these individuals can cover their dependents through the FEOP organization. What's interesting, though, is as I talk to new businesses, people start a new business, and one of the things they want to do is provide health insurance for their employees. Once we get bids for these individuals and show them the costs, they simply don't buy it. They just can't afford it at this time. And this is why I think some of these certified plans that IPGB has come forth might be helpful, as it will hopefully provide a lower cost alternative to allow people to provide some coverage. It's not as good as what's being offered in the CHI market, but hopefully it will be some coverage. And also, one thing I'd like to suggest that the legislature consider, when the Insurance Book Governing Board was first established years ago, it included a tax credit for small employers to provide health insurance. That went away, and of course that costs money, but I think that the legislature could consider a way to provide some sort of a financial incentive for these new businesses to provide coverage that would be well received. What employers are doing in reaction to the cost is they're, rather than just dropping coverage, they're increasing deductibles and co-pays, or asking employees to pay a larger portion of the premium. Most employers are now looking seriously at health savings accounts or funding or establishing a large deductible plan and funding that deductible with a health reimbursement arrangement, or an HRA. I'm not sure how much detail you want about those kinds of plans. I'm happy to answer some questions about that, but that's kind of what the employers are doing. What I would suggest that the legislature consider is to certainly support FEOP and expand it if possible. For the reasons that Rocky indicated, most people would prefer to buy a private health insurance plan as opposed to be enrolled in a government plan. It gives them greater access to more providers. It also doesn't have the stigma of a government-run program. But most importantly, I think as we enroll people, if the government's going to be involved in providing health insurance for people, if they can provide a subsidy for them to buy a private health insurance plan, it eliminates the cost shift. And that will help in the long run. The more people get enrolled in private plans, the lesser the impact of those cost shifts. We would support encouraging the legislature to not impose any new mandates. That's also a very sensitive subject. And I know that some of the mandates appear to be very important, and they may well be. And you could, some people argue that the cost of the mandates aren't very much, only a percentage or two. But as you can see from the dollar amounts that these employers are facing, a percentage or two on this large amount of a large figure is significant, and it might be the difference between whether they provide coverage or not.
What about extension of some existing mandates that are set to expire?
Chair Dalton, we would encourage a look at all of those and determine whether or not they should be continued or not. I think that one of the things we wanted to do with this alternative plans, their certified plans that IPGB has, it allowed them the opportunity to create a plan free of mandates, and we'd like to see that plan. So that plan is out there, but I would encourage the legislature to look at those mandates and determine whether or not they should be continued or not. One thing I would hope that the legislature might consider is expanding the rate bands in the CHI market. Last session, they expanded from 2-1 to 2.5-1. It's a very complicated subject, not enough time to explain how the rate bands work. But in theory, as we expand the rate bands, it helps lower the premium for the younger age population. And as we attract that younger age population, it'll help drive down the geographic average rate for the entire band. And if that were to happen, it could lower the cost for the higher people on the higher end as well, as you track this younger age. When Senate Bill 152 was first passed, which is the CHI legislation, the rate band was 3-1. and then a couple of years later it reduced to 2-to-1. And there's some data that indicates that when that happened, we saw a significant number of small employers drop coverage as a result of that, because it raised the premium for the younger, healthier people who feel like they don't need the coverage. We think that expanding that rate band would be helpful. Right now it's 2.5. We'd encourage it to go to at least a 3, and we'd like to see it go to 4-to-1. And there's been some discussion about OMIP assessments and the problem with insurance companies not writing waivers, even though they can write waivers, and even though they can write issue other policies other than the ones applied for. It's very frustrating for us and very frustrating for the insureds that the insurance companies are not doing this. And I don't know what the legislature can do to force them to do it, but we would certainly like to encourage them to do this, because as this happens, there are a lot of people who are now being forced into OMIP, who don't want to be in OMIP, who have relatively minor health conditions. They would be happy to accept an individual policy with a waiver on a particular condition for a period of time instead of being forced into OMIP. But they're going there because the carriers simply aren't taking advantage of legislation that was passed the last time. And as they go there, that increases the assessments to insurance carriers that are ultimately passed on in premiums to employers. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Chair, just a quick and brief check question from Commissioner Doty. You'd indicated that maybe the insurance companies aren't offering the product based upon expanded state law, or people are not buying their insurance from those companies to take advantage of these newer products that are being offered as a result of state law.
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, no. What I meant was that the carriers simply aren't offering those products. If you're referring to the individual products,
yes, sir.
Under current law, if you were to apply for a health insurance plan and you had a relatively minor health condition, maybe a bad back, for example, the way the carriers are currently underwriting that is they either accept the application or they reject it, and most of them would just reject the application outright, and the only option would then be to go to OMIP. What the law that was passed last session allows them to do is to place a specific waiver on that specific condition over a period of time, 6 months to, I think, 18 months was the maximum that they could impose that waiver. And most people would be willing to buy that plan, understanding that particular condition may not be covered for a period of time, so they could have this private plan at a lower cost than be forced into OMIP.
But Mr. Chair, I think the comment was that the companies are just not offering it based upon the fact that it's now an opportunity that they can offer it with the extended waivers. Is there some reason that the insurance companies haven't come forward to offer that product in Oregon?
Chair Dalton, Representative Butler, their response to us has been that their systems won't allow it. And that may be true. I don't doubt their word, but some of them have even indicated on the last advisory committee we attended with the insurance department, we discussed this issue. Some of them indicated that even if their systems did allow it, they wouldn't do it. And I'm at a loss as to why they don't want to do it. It's very frustrating, and I'm not sure what we can do to fix it, because the legislation has been passed to allow them to do it. I just hope they would do it.
Maybe we can explore that more offline. Additional questions? Well, Steve, I appreciate you being here today. I know that we had to reschedule you previously, so I appreciate you bearing with us on the committee, and hopefully you'll be available to some folks. I know I'd like to call you to explore some of these issues in greater depth. We just don't have the time to do that here, but hopefully you'll be willing to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. For our last panel, I'd like to bring up Lisa Trussell with the Associated Oregon Industries and J.L. Wilson with the NFIB together, if you could. We'll try to do about 15 or 20 minutes if possible. Good morning, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dalton. For my part, I'll keep it much more brief than that. J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business. I represent just over 12,000 companies here in the state of Oregon. I can only refer to what we've seen on our own surveys of our membership. We do a health insurance survey of our membership every year. And what we have seen Our peak performance, I should say, back in 1996, the most number of NFIB members offered insurance to their employees. That was in 1996, and you had an employer participation rate of about 70%. Now, when I started lobbying for NFIB, it was about 63.1, and that was my first session in 2001, and today we're at 60.4, which we've seen just a gradual decline in the number of small employers offering health insurance benefits to their employees, which kind of affirms what Steve Doty said before me. Most employers are, in fact, holding on to their coverage, but the first line of defense is usually to exclude dependents and go to employee only, and then you look at plans where you are increasing copays and deductibles. But one of the things I found interesting in our last survey of employers back in 2004 was that when you had a 60.4% coverage, we asked about premium increases every year, and only about one in four, or a little less than one in four, were able to keep their premium increases under 10%. That means 75% of the businesses that I represent saw their premiums increase 11% or higher. And in fact, we've seen an average premium increase of 11 to 15% for each of the last 6 or 7 years, dating back to before the year 2000. But we had just under a quarter were able to keep their premiums under a 10% increase, and that's consistent with 2003 as well. 40% saw their premiums jump between 11 and 20%. 21% saw their premiums increase 21 to 30%, and 14% saw increases of 30% or more. And we've seen that that's been pretty consistent for the last couple of years. About 1 in 4 are able to keep their premiums under a 10% increase, and about 15% on average see their premiums go up 30%. And that's just the dollars and cents aspect of a health insurance consumer like the businesses that I represent. And that's really all I have to offer, a steady stream of premium increases, which has led to slightly decreased participation rates and certainly higher requirements of employees in participating in their own health insurance plans. Now, with regard to NFIB, obviously last session we supported House Bill 2537, which was what Mr. King alluded to, and House Bill 2987, which is what Mr. Doty alluded to with regard to expanding rate bands and the waivers for pre-existing conditions. I think there was even a 5% employer discount for full participation in the plans in that bill as well. And those are peripheral issues that certainly help. They don't hurt us by any means. It's frustrating to know that the insurers aren't offering that product. But we've turned our attention to the federal level because that's where we think we can get the most bang for our buck in terms of solutions that have some solid dollars and cents impacts on our members, which is why you'll see our association supporting association health plans at the federal level, and a lot of our employers are excited about HSAs and are either starting to participate in them now or have plans to in the next year, and that's really where we see things going with our membership and the thrust of our participation in the political process to change things for the benefit of small employers.
Yes, thank you. Just a brief comment. I HSAs first came out, it struck me as being a terrible idea in the sense that it segmented the market in such a bad way. But it's very clear that for small business, particularly small business owners, HMAs seem like a big piece of the solution. But I have a more philosophical question. As you point out, about 60% of your members provide some kind of health insurance. They're heavily subsidizing the 40% of your members and other businesses who don't provide some kind of health insurance coverage. And there is a cost shift, obviously. I mean, we've seen the specific one of $1.52 a month, but there are other cost shifts that are moving in that direction. Do you support any model that will help get to a place where all businesses can afford to and can have available the kind of health insurance that they need at least to start a base of health insurance coverage, or you see employment-based health insurance is basically on its way out? I mean, you see that pendulum to continue to swing in the direction it's swinging.
Thank you, Chair Dalton and Representative Greenlake. Undoubtedly, this is the toughest issue I've ever worked on and probably will ever work on because of that philosophical question that actually pits some businesses against each other. I know that full well. You know, our association has been on the record for years as opposing a mandated coverage for employers by virtue of the fact that we'd rather some businesses be in business than some of them go out of business by virtue of having mandated coverage like that.
So would we answer that one, even alone with that concern.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Dalton, Representative Greenlee. So I understand the tension that's involved in this issue. But what we're engaged in terms of on the federal level, is let small businesses band together, get some economies of scale, and try to go with the HSA model. But I fully recognize the tension that you allude to, and that's a very tough issue.
Thank you, sir.
Are you in a position to work with some of your members about encouraging them to cover dependents, even if they can't afford to cover the employees themselves, and how those conversations go?
Certainly, Chair Dalto. We certainly, in a position of representing that vast number of businesses, are I think uniquely suited to have those types of conversations and persuade some folks. Sure.
Are you achieving any success in having folks get kids signed up?
From my end, I'd have to say it hasn't been a huge thrust of my particular organization here in Oregon. But that's just God honest truth.
Yeah.
So no.
Okay. Okay. Representative Anderson, did you have something? No. Okay. Lisa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here this morning. I passed out my comments, and those are basically the responses that I received when we emailed our members who have voiced an interest in health policy issues. And what I'd like to point out is they're very similar to the materials that Mr. Doty presented to you, although I didn't see his materials until this morning. And so I think it's fairly consistent with what you're going to see in the employer market. A couple of things that I'd like to comment on that aren't on my testimony is that I would like to remind this committee that when you're talking about health insurance mandates, that you are talking about the group insurance market, which is about 500,000 Oregonians, as Mr. Ario stated this morning. So you're impacting a smaller percentage of Oregonians by mandating that certain policies have to carry certain coverages. The other thing is that there is no silver bullet to the rising cost of health insurance. This is an issue that is not just faced in Oregon, but our counterparts across the nation are struggling with the high cost of health insurance. And the drivers you've seen, I presented some, Mr. Doty presented some. And then there's been a lot of discussion in the last two legislative sessions, and I expect this one also, that to see what we can do about targeting employers who are currently offering no insurance. And that's fine, but it's a little bit like targeting companies that are out of Oregon to come in and not taking care of the needs of the companies that are already here. So it is a problem for employers who are currently buying insurance every bit as much as it is for those employers who aren't. And you talked about the hit upon the OMIP assessment, which is $1.52 per person right now, and that doesn't seem like much. But when you look at the context of how much insurance costs, and Mr. Doty gave you some examples on employee-only up to family coverage, the other thing that I think that you'll see before the session's over is the small group market printouts, which is done by regions. There's six geographic regions on the small employer market. And the price variances on those policies for employee only and family coverage. Representative Anderson's district typically, and I haven't looked at the most recent numbers, but typically his district is a very high cost district. Representative Butler pointed out this morning the devastation when a major employer goes out of business. And how that affects. AOI has been very supportive of public-private partnerships, and one of those is the FEOP program. And we promote that within our membership. As you might know, AOI offers a health purchasing co-op for our small members of 2 to 50, and we just recently implemented an HSA arrangement for our members with up to 100 employees. And those are things that we're doing because the market is asking for them. But we haven't escaped premium increases any more than any other employer. So I guess if I were leaving, I would say that I would look closely at the mandates, the ones that are up for that should be triggered for a renewal, to see if there's still something that we should be doing. And I'd also be very cautious of passing any new mandates, regardless of how well intended. It's not to say that any of those mandates are not well intended. They are. But the problem is, particularly in the small group market, that at some point, a 1% increase is going to cause people to drop off. Or if the employer continues to provide it, the employee is probably not going to be able to pay for the dependent coverage. So I think that, you know, those are tough decisions you have to make, but they have to be made with the realization that they have real consequences in the workforce. And I thank you for your time.
I appreciate it. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, just one comment. Lisa, the very last paragraph on your handout indicates that that the legislators have identified 24 services. Those are the mandates that we've got in there. They're required for group health insurance. And we have a list of mandates that were passed out to us previously. Are there any ongoing discussions of the mandates that your members or the members of NFIB might be willing to forego? And this was a conversation I had with my Chambers of Commerce recently, that they would like to forego a lot of things if it were offered through the insurance through Joe Ariel's shop. So I'm anxious to know, are your folks, would they entertain discussions of some of these items if we offered a pilot program in counties where they just wanted catastrophic coverage, basically, and didn't need or so that they could continue to offer something, would be willing to forego some of the mandates for a short period of time in order to bring folks under the umbrella?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we haven't actually had that direct conversation with our membership, but I'm sure it's something they'd be interested in. Our goal isn't to deny people coverage. Our goal is to increase the number of insured Oregonians. Another product that will be released in March that was briefly touched upon is the result of House Bill 2537, which has the cap on the first 2 years of how much the expenditures can be. That might be a good starting point, particularly for the areas where there's a high uninsured population.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I think we had a question from staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lisa, on your last bullet where you talk about the rising costs, you say the disconnect between the consumer and the payer. If there's a disconnect, do you have a sense why and how can it be fixed?
Well, I think part of it is, Mr. Chair and committee administrator, the situation, I think, deals with the fact that the person who's getting the treatment is typically not the person who's paying the bill. And so I think these HSA-style arrangements or the HRAs, I think that as we're responsible for a bigger portion of our own health insurance coverage, we'll be asking more questions. And I use this as an example, which many of you've heard before, but if I want to get eyeglasses, I can go in on a Sunday and get them. And typically it's because I'm paying cash, and if I have insurance, I'm going to bill them later. So they've set those facilities up around the consumer, whereas most of the medical community is not set up around that. So I think that that's something that is that we'll see a shift in as HSAs become more popular.
President Tomei.
Thank you. Lisa, I just want to make sure that it's possible now for employers to buy catastrophic health insurance, high deductibles. Is that correct?
Yes. There's a market of $1,000 deductibles plans out there currently. With the HSA, if you want to use the IRS tax-deferred portion, it has to be a little bit higher deductible. I think the minimum might be $1,500. But it could be 13, so don't quote me on that. But I know it's higher than the $1,000 to tie it in with the IRS.
And what proportion do you think of employers would buy that plan?
Well, I can only speak to our own experience within AOI Health mm-hmm. Choice. And frankly, the bulk of our members until recently were in the richer benefit plan. which was a $250 deductible. There's been a slow shift to the $500 deductible, and I think, frankly, it's because the cost break between the two isn't enough at, you know, to warrant it. And then we have a $1,000 deductible is probably the least popular. But I think that you're seeing, as costs go up, shifts to that area. But the other thing is, if you're going to go to a $1,000 deductible, it might be better to go into the higher deductible, the $1,500 plan, so that your employees and you can put money, pre-tax dollars, aside, similar to a flexible spending account to reach that money. And then the other good thing about an HSA that's different from a flexible spending account is that with a flexible spending account, if you don't use it that year, you lose it, whereas with the HSA, it rolls over.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I appreciate you both being here today, and hopefully you'll be available for any questions that might come up. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Are there any members of the public that are here that wish to add public comment? I didn't see anybody signed up, but if there's anybody in the back there, we'd be happy to hear from you. Doesn't look like there is. So I think with that, we'll adjourn our meeting for today.